please rise? Court is now in session. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court's ready to hear argument in Kaiser versus State. Are you ready to proceed? Good morning, Mr. O'Donnell.
Good morning, Justice Holland, and may it please the court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell. I'm here on behalf of Detective Michael Kaiser, who was convicted of murder and associated charges in the Superior Court of Kent County. I know the court has reviewed the briefing and is familiar with the facts described therein. This argument will not dwell on the facts. Essentially, it raises several legal issues. I'd like to address two of them this morning at oral argument. One is the issue that was raised in the briefing, and at first occurred in the record of the trial, and that issue concerns the remarks by the trial court to trial counsel, which occurred before the jury. First, I'd like to reemphasize that, as I did try to emphasize in our brief, that had this not occurred before the jury, there really would have been no problem, because the defendant's right to fair trial would not have been affected, unless there was some restriction on cross-examination, which could be shown, but that's not an issue here. The issue here is that the interplay between the trial court and defense trial counsel does occur before the jury. And we are arguing in our opening brief that it could have prejudiced the defendant's right to counsel before the jury because it cast a bad light on counsel, the unfortunate exchanges. Now,
there was no request for a curative instruction, was there?
No, there was no request for a curative instruction.
So this is a plain error standard of review?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Okay.
Now,
and does the record reflect why defense counsel and the judge seem to have this contentious relationship? How did it get started?
It started. That's all I can say, Your Honor. I'm not familiar with any history there. There's nothing evident from the record. I don't think there needs to be anything evident for the court to rule upon this record. Perhaps the trial court felt a heightened need to control counsel because of past history. That
well,
would be
it seemed unusual when they were off the record and they had the exchange about co-counsel rolling her eyes. The judge went on to say, "You're going to wind up sitting in a place that you're not going to enjoy."
Yes, sir. That was part of the problem. I don't know. Sometimes the trial court does have a need to, control counsel. Maybe, that's part of the trial court's discretion. If the trial court senses from past experience things might get out of hand, sure, the trial court can exercise vigilance and control, but so long as it doesn't prejudice counsel in the eyes of the jury. And that was the problem here. The state doesn't contest that. The state does not argue here that any of the remarks would not have led the jury to draw an adverse view of defendant's counsel. The state also does not argue quarrel with the descriptions as of what occurred. And insofar as counsel's description of what occurred, the record is very evident. I tried to put everything in the appendix. And I just want to point out that the state doesn't even mention what occurred here.
Well, the state argues that the evidence was overwhelming, especially when you take into consideration the defendant's own statements.
That's an argument I intended to address here, and to what extent is that true? But it's not true as to another extent. The state takes a broad view of it, and to the extent that, there was evidence here against the defendant to convict him. And if you look at the state's brief, there was sufficient evidence to convict. The question is of what? Now, I didn't want to get to it at that point, but this ties in with my second argument. If this defense closing argument is, and it was striking to me in reviewing the record and reviewing the defense closing argument, to be candid with the court, there really wasn't a strong defense to the strong state's evidence as to the defendant's culpability for something. And what we're suggesting here, and it was very evident in the defense closing argument, defense counsel, Ms. Savitz, pointed out what I think is, and the state doesn't agree with it in their briefing, so this distinction, she pointed out the real potential flaw in the state's case, that the defendant had not caused the homicide. perhaps there was intention to cause the homicide, that's an element of attempted murder. But it was evident that there was a weakness in the state's case here insofar as the attempted homicide for which a lesser included offense instruction was not given. So given that, despite all the defendant's statements, despite all of the state's evidence, that is the Achilles heel in the defense case. As state's counsel has described it in their briefing, and I looked at the wording of it, the state describes it as her being, the brief at page 13, her being apparently dead. That's a very telling description of the state's evidence, apparently dead. She may not have been. There may have been a reasonable doubt as to this, which one or more jurors could have focused on had there been an instruction as given as there should have been for attempted murder, given all of the evidence. Now, in addition, the state argues that
help us find the reasonable basis in the record for the conclusion she was alive, because the record seems to indicate the two people involved thought she was dead. So they think she's dead. They're the only two people that are there.
Mm-hmm.
What distinguish between a reasonable basis for thinking she's alive and speculation or something?
There could have been intervening events here. She was not, there was no expertise to lend credence to the fact that she was dead when, as the state describes it, she was apparently dead. She may not have been. People have appeared to have expired when in fact they have not. And in fact, just recently, there was a lady who was extricated from a car right here, just over to the east of here, who was found by paramedics to be dead. An hour later, she wasn't.
Well, I understand that, but we've said many times in our cases, you know, if someone testifies under oath, even though it might be contradicted by the physical evidence, that if they've said that under oath, it provides a record basis for a lesser-included instruction. My question is, where in this record is there a basis for a lesser-included offense on attempted murder when the only two people in the room thought she was dead?
Well, I bring back my illustration about the only two paramedics who were there thought that lady was dead, and they had this expertise. Here you have two bumbling amateurs, and I don't mean to be cavalier about that, but what got into their minds, and you know, we're not defending the state of mind here. We're defending the necessary element of causing death at that time. And we submit that based upon the evidence here, that there could have been, and the gaps in the state's evidence, that there could have been a reasonable doubt that a juror found as to the defendant causing the homicide. Certainly.
Get into the state's response. Again, this is a plain error argument. It wasn't requested by defense counsel. So based on our prior decisions that we let counsel decide how the case is going to be submitted to the jury, in the absence of a request from defense counsel, how can we possibly conclude this is plain error?
Well, we can conclude it's plain error because, in essence, it was the only defense given the state's evidence. And it's as if there was evidence presented concerning self-defense at trial. And by reason of counsel and the trial court's focus on other matters, there was a lot of evidentiary difficulties at the trial, et cetera. Somehow, everybody overlooked oversight, and oversight is plain error. I suggest there's no reason for a tactical decision here, as the state suggests, to not ask for the only instruction which will benefit, says your client. It was oversight, says in plain error, and under those circumstances, with, let's say, a self-defense instruction or any type of defense instruction, if it is unintentionally omitted, depriving the jury of an opportunity to give effect, says, to the evidence, you know, we submit that it's plain error.
Is this something that should be developed on the record in a Rule 61 motion alleging ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, it shouldn't be done there because there could be no tactical reason for counsel not to ask for a lesser included offense instruction. This is based on the record. Absolutely none. It was the only card that could be played at this trial, given the state's evidence. I have to give credit to the defense counsel who did the closing argument. It was skillful, but she was facing a plethora of evidence insofar as trying to suggest the defendant wasn't culpable of anything. When she hit upon the fact that he may not have caused the homicide, that was something tangible and substantive based upon all of the evidence at trial. But there was no instruction to give effect to that argument, and it was evidently oversight. There were instructions for manslaughter, criminal negligent homicide, all of which are relevant to this point, but really there was no discussion as to those instructions, and they really weren't, those were less warranted by the evidence than attempted murder. The state argues, in addition, insofar as the remarks counts before the jury, that basically there should be no remedy here because there was no request for instruction, and therefore there was a waiver. As I've suggested before, a waiver suggests a known abandonment or relinquishment of a known right. And there's no purpose to be served here by waiving such an instruction. State argues that it was a tactical decision. Of what benefit was it to the defense to exercise this kind of tactical decision? It was an omission. It was an oversight. Unfortunate, but it was. Why even address it in closing argument if there's not an instruction that will give it effect? The state argues that the defendant's burden to demonstrate plain error and that it's prejudicial. The state argues that the defense should have asked for an instruction to disregard the court's comments to counsel, as happened in Muhammad. That should have occurred. We can't quarrel with that as a legal proposition. However, in Muhammad, there was an instruction. Here there was no instruction, meaning there was no prejudice that was cured. So that, in effect, supports our argument as to prejudice of the defendant's right to a fair trial and counsel who is not disparaged before the jury. I have a question. How does the finding of a waiver assure a fair trial? Well, we look at how does, punishing the defendant or penalizing, how does penalizing the defendant deter counsel's error? In addition, under these circumstances, as the court pointed out, this regrettably reached the stage at one point where the court's familiar with it. I have a tab here in the appendix, but the court essentially made some remarks at one point. One more remark out of you, counsel. Counsel's taking a risk under those circumstances, saying anything at all. Even, Your Honor, will you instruct the jury to disregard your comments to me? Now, counsel has said that under those circumstances, and again, this court's an experienced court. This is a very sensitive argument for counsel to argue. The state pointed out that the defense alleged judicial misconduct in the briefing. That's in the summary of argument. We did not utter the word judicial misconduct or anything close to it. This may have been warranted based upon a history here, so to speak, visual displays, whatever, but it wasn't warranted before the jury. And that's prejudice. I'm not a judge, and I wouldn't pretend to try to argue that there was judicial misconduct here. All we are arguing is that there was unfortunate and avoidable prejudice to our client's right to fair trial. Insofar as a waiver, that places counsel in a difficult position too, because counsel is in a conflict. In a sense, the defendant is represented by counsel at that point who has a conflict, because these are uncomfortable circumstances for any trial counsel, but when you get that warning says from a trial court, the gears are turning in your head that if there's one more word out of you, your next words are going to be spoken trying to contact somebody to get you out of the lockup, or you're paying a fine. So you've got conflicted counsel, too, under those circumstances. Insofar as the lesser included offense instructions, is the lack of that, the state doesn't dispute that The attempted murder, in its briefing, the state doesn't dispute that the attempted murder instruction is a lesser included offense of murder. The state, under 206, the state does not dispute that it would have been warranted by this evidence in the briefing. And the state did not dispute there could have been reasonable doubt as to the completion of the homicide. The state referred to the apparently dead. And in addition, I'd like to close my remarks with the fact that if there was no instruction for the lesser included offense, there was no defense in this case. And that amounts to plain error. If the court permits, I'd like to reserve any other comments to rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Williams.
Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs. May it please the court. I'll address the two arguments, or arguments 1 and 4, that have been addressed in oral argument today, but if the court has any questions about the other two arguments, 2 and 3, I'll certainly attempt to answer those as well. The first argument concerns three exchanges, I guess, between defense counsel and the trial judge that occurred. This was approximately a 13-day guilt phase trial. The first two exchanges occurred, I believe, on the fifth day of trial, and the third exchange occurred on the seventh day of trial. Just to put this in a factual context, the first exchange is at page 814 of the appellant's appendix, and in that, the court cautions one of the defense counsel. Mr. Kaiser had two attorneys at trial, cautions one of the defense counsel about what appears to be, I guess, repetitive questioning of a witness, Kathy Pippen, who was the accused girlfriend, and she was being asked about a series of different telephone calls she had received from the defendant here, and the court's comment was, Mr. Gabay, this isn't real hard to follow. She wasn't asleep at 1 o'clock. She went to sleep, woke up at 4 o'clock because Mr. Kaiser wasn't there. She is concerned. Now she can't go back to sleep. So I don't know how you are trying to characterize it, but that is what it is. Let's move on to some perhaps relevant inquiry. And then Mr. Gabay says, okay, thank you, Your Honor. And the court says, you're welcome. The trial judge certainly has authority to control repetitive questioning here. If something has already been examined fully in the record, it's not inappropriate for the trial judge simply to state that as a matter of fact and tell defense counsel to move on. I don't think this can be characterized as an acrimonious exchange at all. He's simply telling the defense counsel that, well, you've answered this, this is what she said, these are phone calls, I think, that are occurring during the night that the homicide is alleged to have occurred. And that's been exhausted in the record. It's time to move on. So I don't think this first exchange is really inappropriate in any fashion. The second exchange between defense counsel and the trial judge also occurs during this fifth day of trial. And at that point, Mr. Gabay's says, this is at page, the very bottom of page A16 of the appellant's appendix. Mr. Gabay says, all right, and we agree that the jury's recollection as to the question and answer that controls, correct? And then the court says, this is top of page A17, and we also agree, Mr. Gabay, that I will be the one who will give the jury instructions. Isn't that correct, sir? Mr. Gabay, yes, Your Honor, the court. So if we have this discussion anymore, it will be very unpleasant, okay? Mr. Gabay, do we understand each other? Mr. Gabay, absolutely, Your Honor. I am not re-arguing. You sustained it. And the court says, we are not arguing about what you and I, what our roles are, Mr. Gabay. No, I am not arguing with the court at all. The court, you may continue. Now, I think here, this remark by defense counsel, and we agree that the jury's recollection is to the question and answer that controls. I don't really think that's an appropriate remark for defense counsel to be making during a trial. The judge is correct in saying that he's the one who's going to be instructing the jury, and it's almost presumptuous for defense counsel to be suggesting that in front of the jury as to what the instructions are. That's why we have jury prayer conferences, so that can be resolved in chambers.
But was it necessary for the trial judge to go on then and, affect the main defense counsel before the jury?
Well, I don't know that he demeaned him. I think he's just saying, look, these are our roles, and if you do something further, then it's going to be an unpleasant exchange. Now, perhaps that's an unfortunate choice of words, but ultimately, I don't think it so impacted defense counsel's role in this case that he was denied his right to counsel by any means.
Would you agree that that it would have been preferable that the judge's remarks be made outside the presence of the jury?
Oh, absolutely. That's certainly preferable, and would have been preferable if defense counsel had not started this whole thing by saying, and we agree that the jury's recollection as to the question and answer that controls correct. I think that's just sort of inviting the exchange that did occur here. The final exchange, I believe, occurs on page, A18 and 19, and this occurs during the seventh day of trial. And as best I can figure out from the context here, it appears that there's two defense attorneys, and one defense attorney is handling a cross examination or a redirect examination of a witness, and for some reason the other defense counsel stands up and starts talking. And I think under this circumstance, it's certainly appropriate for the trial judge to remind defense counsel what the ground rules are. Normally, when you have multiple counsel, one individual assumes the role of handling objections and cross or direct examination of a witness, and the reason you don't have multiple defense counsel jumping up and making objections or statements is it becomes very complex for the court reporter to keep everything settled. And I think all the trial judge did in this third instance was simply remind both defense counsel as to exactly what the role is and what the ground rules are. I don't think that's inappropriate. The trial judge certainly has inherent authority to control the conduct of the trial, including controlling the conduct of defense counsel if that becomes necessary.
That's not an issue, though. I don't understand the other side to be arguing the contrary. The question is, when counsel is dressed down by the court in front of the jury, that's bound to have some effect on the jury's perception of defense counsel and, by extension, the client's case. That's the problem that needs to be addressed.
Well, I think, and if that is perceived to be a significant enough problem, then as the Mohammed case says, what defense counsel should do is ask the trial judge to give a curative instruction in the opening or preliminary instructions to the jury on the very first day of trial before there was even any opening statements. The trial judge was talking about objections and rulings and how the evidence would be presented, and the trial judge said at that time, addressing the jury, says, nor are you to infer or conclude from any ruling or any comment that I make that I have any opinions on the merits of the case favoring one side or the other. And that's a pretty standard preliminary instruction that's given. So I think the jury's told from the outset that the trial judge is impartial here, that regardless of...
Well, Justice Jacobs' question goes to, if we had to do this with 20/20 hindsight, would you agree that all of these exchanges should have taken place at sidebar?
Yes, I think that would certainly have been appropriate. And if that was the case, I don't see that there's any harm to the defendant under those circumstances. Ultimately here, because there wasn't a request for a jury curative instruction, I think what you're left with is deciding whether or not this ultimately impacted adversely on the defendant in this case. And it's the state's position that there really wasn't any plain error in this particular instance, and the defendant has not sustained his burden of proof in showing any particular plain error here.
Let me interrupt for a second, because I think this is a difficult situation in many respects. One respect being our role in this when we're looking at a paper record. You do get the impression, at least, that this judge had a real problem with with one of the two defense attorneys in this case. And even the last colloquy that's referred to in the opening brief, where it's a question of them both standing up at the same time to make an objection, the court is aggressively disappointed with what's going on, and winds up with the one defense counsel saying, "I'm not going into the objection, Your Honor. I just want to be able to, once we are done, to put it on the record what we would have objected to." And the court says, "Well, no." And then he says, "Can I confer with counsel?" And the court says, "She's sitting right next to you. You can confer as much as you'd like to." I mean, those sound like they could have been very sarcastic and very demeaning in terms of the court telling counsel, "I'm fed up with you. You're not properly handling this matter," and not being particularly respectful. Now, I'm not saying that the court has to be polite all the time, regardless of the circumstances, but what I think the concern is here is that it's a problem, and it's hard to tell how much it impacted the jury. Are we just supposed to say, well, it doesn't look so bad?
Well, I think you have to analyze the whole thing in context. We're talking about three remarks that occurred just focusing on the guilt phase. There was a penalty phase that was conducted after this as well. But the guilt phase, as I said, was 13 days of testimony. And we had three exchanges that have been highlighted here. First two occurred on the fifth day, and the last one occurred on the seventh day. I think when you look at the entirety of it here, it was not a situation. While none of these exchanges probably should have occurred in the presence of a jury, the state certainly agrees with that, but what is the impact on the defendant's right to a fair trial? I don't think you can conclude that there's
Mr. O'Donnell suggests in his brief in answer to that question that when you look at the closing argument and the trial judge is thanking the prosecution for their closing argument and barely acknowledging the closing argument of the defense, that's indicative of the tone that was set during the course of the trial, that there was this tension with trial counsel for the defense, and they didn't know what they were doing, and that the court was polite to the prosecution.
Well, I do have two trial prosecutors here, and I mean, admittedly, we're just reading what's there in the record, and some things may sound sarcastic and in context, but may not have been.
Well, even the off-the-record comments, the judge said, "I've stood in your place many times, and I know how it's supposed to be done," and was suggesting that defense counsel should get their act together and smile. And this is the same exchange about rolling your eyes. Which, even in the off-the-record exchange, it's pretty clear that the trial judge doesn't like the way defense counsel are conducting themselves.
Well, I don't think he certainly didn't appreciate some of the things that were being done. I guess there was discussions about how defense counsel was acting when the state was either examining witnesses or making argument here, and that's inappropriate conduct anyway. I mean, defense counsel shouldn't be doing that. The second comment, I think defense counsel precipitated that by his own impertinent remark that started the whole thing. So I think if you look at the whole thing in total, though, there isn't an overriding impression that somehow the defendant's fair trial was derailed here. The evidence in this case was substantial. The evidence came primarily from the defendant's own mouth. He made a statement to the state police in which he admitted his complicity in the homicide. What he said was he held the woman's legs down so that the other perpetrator who had committed suicide before the trial, that individual could suffocate her, and that he then participated in wrapping her body in a blanket and duct taping it up, and then after that the body was apparently dumped in the Atlantic Ocean.
Well, he also made inconsistent statements about the last time that he'd seen her that were contradicted by the videotaped surveillance.
certainly his initial attempts was to allay suspicion from himself. When he was asked by the police the last time he had seen the homicide victim, he said 4 or 5 months previously, but there was a videotape from a Wawa store here in Dover that showed him in the company of the victim on the night that the homicide apparently occurred, the very early morning. He had also asked his girlfriend, Kathy Pippen, to fabricate an alibi for him that he was working on the night of the homicide. So I think certainly those things, the suicide attempt at the prison after he made the incriminatory admissions to the police and was incarcerated, and the two letters, one's apparently a holographic will or attempted a holographic will, all indicate a sense of remorsefulness and a consciousness of guilt here. And I think all of that evidence was presented to the jury, and that's really what the jury had here. So under those circumstances, with that overwhelming amount of evidence, I think any unfortunate comments or exchanges that may have occurred during the trial cannot amount to plain error in this particular instance. The
your position is that these exchanges, most of them should not have taken place in the presence of the jury, but to the extent there wasn't a request for a curative instruction under the plain error standard of review, given the overwhelming nature of the other evidence, there was no reversible error.
Yes, I think that's true. You have to show some reasonable possibility that there was going to be a different result. And defense counsel had a very tough case. I mean, admittedly, there was a lot of evidence here, and there wasn't much else to argue. The defense that I thought was being asserted was that somehow this was done under duress, that Mr. Kaiser had at one point or another had said that the co-defendant, the individual committed suicide, had threatened him with a shotgun and said that if he didn't go along with this plan, he was going to not only shoot Mr. Kaiser, but Mr. Kaiser's girlfriend, Kathy Pippen. And I thought that was really the defense here, was that it wasn't that he didn't participate in intentional conduct, it's simply that he did so under duress. Why defense counsel made the argument about, well, nobody knows for sure exactly when the homicide victim was dead, but had not requested an attempted first-degree murder instruction, I don't know. But Delaware has adopted the party autonomy rule that the trial judge is not sua sponte ordinarily supposed to give an uncharged lesser-included offense instruction where neither side requests it, and that's what happened here. Neither side requested any instruction on attempted first-degree murder. The evidentiary basis would have to be pretty thin, I think, here. We don't have a situation where the medical examiner is able to point to some exact time of death, as in most homicides here. All we know is that she's apparently suffocated. The individual, Mr. Jacobs, who had committed suicide, he says she's dead, and then he goes out and gets a blanket and duct tape in a car, comes back into the motel room, and he and Mr. Kaiser then proceed to wrap up the body inside the blanket. Don't know if she died from suffocation initially in the motel room or when she's placed in the blanket or exactly where, but obviously when her body is discovered days later in the ocean, she's dead. And she's been duct taped, she's had chains attached to her ankle, and cinder blocks are attached to the chains, and she's apparently thrown out of an airplane into the Atlantic Ocean, and the body's discovered here. But I don't think under these circumstances and this evidentiary record, there was certainly any reason for the trial judge to sua sponte think that he should be giving an instruction on attempted first-degree murder. He did instruct the jury on second-degree murder, manslaughter, and criminally negligent homicide, so the jury had all of those options if they thought that the conduct was somehow less culpable than an intentional homicide here, but the jury returned a verdict of guilty of intentional first-degree murder in this case, and I think that was appropriate. The trial judge's actions were certainly appropriate, and it's in accordance with the rules announced by this court in the State versus Cox decision, the 2003 decision, that very clearly delineates that Delaware has adopted and follows the party autonomy rule when we're talking about lesser included offense instructions. If there's any questions about the two arguments that have been addressed or the other two arguments that were not discussed, I'll certainly attempt to answer those. Thank you.
Thank you.
As Mr. Williams mentioned, I'd just like to point out that the fact that we didn't address the two remaining arguments in our opening argument was because of the limited time available to oral argument. We're not waiving those arguments. Counsel spent a great deal of his allotted time says arguing that what in effect occurred at trial, the court has seen and viewed as what occurred at trial, was really not that prejudicial to the defense. I just have a rhetorical question as to that. At page 814, counsel related that the court said, Mr. Gabay, this isn't real hard to follow. Now, I submit that there was some confusion in the witness's statement or testimony ahead of time. Maybe Mr. Gabay was trying to resolve that confusion in his own mind. Maybe he was being insulting by grimaces on his face. We don't know. But what occurred before the jury is that the court said, Mr. Gabay, this isn't real hard to follow. Even the state admits that was sarcastic. I just like to point out, what if counsel had said that to the trial court before the jury? Your Honor, this isn't real hard to follow. Would a severe penalty, says, be warranted because of counsel's comments to the trial court before the jury? Would an increased penalty, says, be warranted? There'd be no defense to such a remark. But yet the state is essentially, says, defending this. Insofar as the state's argument that there should have been a curative instruction, I'd just like to reiterate, ideally, says, there should have. However, Mr. Gabay was not Mr. Wallace with a lot of colleagues. He was a single practitioner there before the jury, and he was warned, one more word out of you. That's a conflicted position, says, for counsel under those circumstances. He's not going to have anybody backing him up if he ends up in the lockup or lighter in the wallet. He'll have himself to defend himself. Insofar as the state's argument that there was no request for a lesser included offense instruction, Mr. Williams says, I don't know why there wasn't one. Well, that points out the lack of any tactical reason for not asking for one. It's an omission. It's an oversight. Insofar as the LIOs that were given for murder second degree, manslaughter, and criminally negligent homicide, the entire evidence didn't raise a question as to the elements which distinguish murder first degree, murder second degree, manslaughter, and criminally negligent homicide. The entire evidence really provided defense as to two questions, duress and attempted murder. And there really, my view of the entire record afterwards was attempted murder was a far stronger defense, as probably counsel realized during their own argument. Unfortunately, because of oversight, the jury could not give effect to the weakness or to the potential flaw, the reasonable doubt in the state's case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Judge. The court appreciates your arguments. And the court will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.
Please rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honorable court.